So, welcome. How's Dev Day so far this year? Is it good? Good sessions? You all want to buy the new stuff? Okay, forget about buying, but it's another point, yeah. It's great to see so many people in a session about a very interesting topic like quality. To tell you the truth, there was a study that told me that 50% of the conference attendees attending a session about quality do it up front, before they do something wrong and screw up their project. And 50% of the attendees actually have done something wrong, and they have a huge quality problem. This is why they are here. So if my mathematical skills are correct, the neighbor to your right is the one that has problems with his quality and of his code, of course, right? So you can say hello to him now. Good. So let's see how we can change that. There is one first fundamental problem in the title of this session. I talked about quality. And you're here, so this is good. So it's a very general term, isn't it? Quality. What's quality? What does it mean to you? Anyone want to try to give a short definition of what quality means? In terms of software, of course. What do you think? What's quality? How would you define it for your team? Is it just naming conventions? Is it it compiles? Is it does not have any compiler warnings? You know, that huge number that gets larger and larger? Is that quality? I have a few definitions with me, though. I asked a few of my customers, and they told me things like, it conforms to the requirements. So you have fulfilled exactly what you were supposed to do. Is a way to say that's quality, to define quality. How about you meeting the actual expectations of your end users? Is that something you would say is quality? Or are you considering that today when you build software? Or is it something that has value for somebody? Makes sense, I guess. Then there's the definition of, well, the basic stuff like it doesn't crash, it's fast enough for the purpose, or it fits the purpose we designed it for. So you define the scenario where you want to use that part of software, and if it fits for that purpose, then everything's good and you define this as a quality solution. So I think there are many ways how you can define quality. And what I want from you in your real life is to actually sit down and define quality for you or your team or even your company. It's a very important thing to do as a first step in your new project or in an existing project. Do you think even if in a small team with three people, you have the same definition of quality or definition what you mean when you say you're done? If you as a developer say, I'm 70% done, you mean coding. If your project manager asks you, how far are you? He expects those 70% is done including everything, including testing, building a setup, and doing everything else what you defined. Well, you've never defined it, but you would have defined it then. What is done? So you have to define, talk about quality and define your definition of done. Make it a checklist. Make it explicit. Put it on the wall where everybody can see it. And the important part of it is so you have a common and shared understanding of what quality is. And the second part is now you have a minimum bar that you always have to reach for every feature, for every part of code and bug or whatever you put into your code base. So don't put it too high. Don't have a wish list of 100 things you always wanted to do. Start small, but always do it. If something is not done according to your definition of done, don't put it into the software. Say, we're not done. We can't do it. We missed our goal to put it into our actual code base. So having this means you have a constant quality. It doesn't have to be the highest one on Earth, but it has to be constant. Why? Because a customer doesn't really understand why one feature is perfectly tested and the other one, where you didn't really have that time and it was shortly close to the release date and it's not as tested as the other features are. So you were in a rush and you just had to get that out, so you left a few things out that you would normally do in quality assurance. And so now you have a constant quality once you define it. So you should really do that. When you do that, think about things that you can measure. I had a team that I think they said one definition, or in their definition of done, one thing they wanted to measure is how beautiful the application looks like. How do you want to measure that? Do you want to ask 10 customers and get get grades or something? Well, you can do that. If this is your measure, if you define it that way, that you will always ask your customer for a grade, okay, then it's measurable, do it. But if it's not measurable, don't do it. Don't put it on your definition of done. Why? Because it's the same thing. You're the developer. You have your definition of done. If it's a criteria that you can measure, you can't say, well, it does compile if it doesn't, right? You can't get over that one. But if it says it has to be beautiful, well, I'm short on time. It's beautiful enough. And you would just check it. So that happens if it's not measurable. So the simplest possible definition of done in software development would be it compiles. Well, it's coded. Actually, you coded the thing you are supposed to do. It compiles. And maybe you've even checked it into your version control system like Team Foundation Server. If you really want to extend that, you can say you need a comment when checking in and you want to have a work item you're working on. But I think this is the common sense, right? You implemented it, it compiles, and you checked it in. And now you can do more. You can say, okay, it runs through security tests, performance tests, user acceptance criteria. You can have thousands of things on that list. But again, keep it small. It's a minimum definition of what done actually means to you. Does anyone have a definition of done in the team? One, two. How big is it? How many items do you have on it? Is it like a huge thing or just basics? Or oh, yeah, you also have acceptance testing on it? Okay. Mm-hmm. For business analysts, yes. Nice word. Okay. How about your one? Is it also a large one or shorter? So it's very coding skill-based? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So coding skills definitely are a part of it, but also don't write things like no spaghetti code on your definition of done. While this is definitely true, right, you don't want to have code that looks like spaghetti or waterfall code or code where somebody tried that he can never be removed from that project because nobody can ever read his code again. Of course, this is not the goal, but how do you want to measure it? You can't just write beautiful code. Everybody will say, okay, yeah, that's fine. I've done it. You have to have some measurable criteria. Okay, I think you've got that part. It's very, very important. Don't start with quality before you don't know what quality is. If compiled is enough quality for you, that's fine. By the way, in agile processes like Scrum says the definition of done has to be negotiated between the team, so the actual people implementing, and the product owner, who is the customer representative. So if the team says, well, compiled is enough for us, it just has to compile, the product owner will say, what? Have you thought as a customer? It just compiles is not enough. You will test that solution somehow. Find something, do it manually, do it automated, whatever you like, but just test it. So it has to include everything, not just development, including testing, integration, whatever you want to do, until your software is potentially shippable. A nice word, right? Potentially shippable, which means like one click away from giving it to your customer. Good. Define done. Have an explicit definition of done. This is your constant quality that you can assure that every feature has passed this definition of done. It is not below it, otherwise it wouldn't be in the software. It's also important for estimates. If somebody asks you to give an estimate, a rough estimate of the size, how big is that feature to implement or how long will it take you, you have to consider everything you have to do. And if you don't have the same definition of done as your colleague has, that's an interesting thing that will happen. Right? So also the product owner or the product manager might have another definition of done today. So be careful with estimates before defining done. You can try to have a single definition for your enterprise. That makes easier if you have multiple projects to have one definition, one minimum definition of done. You can still do more, right? Don't get me wrong. If you now have time and there is one critical feature and you want to do a lot of testing, do it. Nobody tells you that you're not allowed to do more testing than a definition of done. But you will not be allowed to do less testing than any definition of done. It should be measurable. We talked about that. And as a result, actually, you want to have this automated. Why? If you do agile software development, your sprints or your iterations might be of 2 weeks. 2 weeks means 10 days. 10 days means you have a start kickoff meeting and you have a review meeting at the end. So you have 8 days left. In those 8 days, you have to create new features, test the new features, integrate the new features, write a handbook maybe for your end users, whatever you want to write for documentation. You have to not only test the new features, but also ensure that your new code has not destroyed or broken anything from the old code. It has to, the existing solution still has to work. So the regression testing part, you have to do that as well in 8 days, which is not a huge amount of time. So everything in the definition of done, because you have to repeat it for every feature, for every user story you implement, you want to have that automated. That was the last slide for today. Let's go over to the real stuff. So what are we going to do? We're trying to automate the definition of done. We're not defining a definition of done, though. We are taking another approach. We're looking at Visual Studio. And let's see what tools are in Visual Studio that could automate the definition of done and just turn them all on. And the build process will take longer and longer and longer, but we'll put it all on. Just turn it on and see if it helps. And then we can define our definition of done later. So I created a brand new application. I'm sure you've never seen the code of a real calculator. It's a very interesting calculation. But to be a little bit more realistic, we'll do it as a three-tier application so that we can really see how a multi-tier distributed app looks like. So let's go. We have EasyCalc, a great WPF application. It's definitely easiest part of my definition of done. It's so easy because there's only one feature. Everybody knows how to use this. Okay, forget about this one. So we are here to add numbers, obviously. That's the easy part. We just started with our project. We still have no definition of done. We just checked it in for the first time in our Team Foundation server. By the way, who is using TFS today? Okay, who's planning to do that? Good. How about people not using TFS 2010 but an older version? You want to upgrade. Good. Thanks. Just for statistics, you know, that's very important. Here we are, the code for equals, and I prepared something already. Don't want to write that here now. And usually it works also. There it is. So we are getting the two numbers from the text boxes. We have a number A, a number B, and we're not doing the math here in our class. We want to do that in our business logic somewhere behind the UI. So we use one of those refactoring functions, generate a new type. It should be a public class called in the project EasyCalc called business logic CS. Please generate that. Now I need a new method in there that is called add. Now we navigate into the add method. And now we're in the business logic. It should be public as well. But actually, I don't think it's a real good idea to have the adding of two numbers in here. We really should have something like a data access layer. And this one has an add method as well. It's not using any data, though, but that's fine. Generate, new type. Public, EasyCalc, data layer, generate, have an add method in there, go into the data layer, that looks brilliant, return the new numbers, do testing as testing is done today, just enter something and hope that the result looks good, it looks great. Wow, perfect. So we are still in the beginning of a new application. And the first thing you really want to do is to activate the build server to at least have a starting point. The build server in TFS is very important because it generates a lot of metrics, like how many code lines have changed from build to build, from day to day, how many compiler warnings are there. Compiler warnings are a good example, though. I mean, you will get a number probably of not zero, but something above zero compiler warnings. Let's say 50. And 50 is okay if it stays 50, or if it goes slightly down from week to week. If it goes up, you might want to talk to your team about your new definition of done, and if compiler warnings might be a thing you want to talk about, or not. But again, you really want that build process. Even if your application doesn't really run or doesn't make sense, but it's still compiled, you want that build server there. The build server will tell you if somebody checked in a file but forgot to put it into the project file of Visual Studio, for example. So if you work with multiple people, you will get immediate feedback. You've seen an automated build, I assume. So first version still without automated build. Now get me that automated build up and running so we can add more definition of done criteria to the build later. So the build definition name will be EasyCalc. This is the main branch, and it will be the CI build, the continuous integration build, that runs after each check-in. It's triggered by the check-in. That's the optimistic approach, that once it's already checked in, the build server will run to check if the code is okay. It's the dev days project, it's not the other project, and we want the main folder. This is the workspace mapping for the build server, so what he will download to the build server, to his temp directory, before he starts compiling and checking quality. The build server is on my machine here, server to go, and will copy the final results to server to go drop location network folder. Now for the build process, if you've created one of those automated builds with a new Microsoft default template, you will see that everything has its default values, and even the only required parameter, what do you want to build, the items to build, is automatically filled in for you because you only have one solution. So nothing else left to do, and now just create your first build. The first build is important because it serves as a baseline, so every new build will be a comparison to the last working build. So you will see the difference, what's new in terms of code changes, what's new in terms of work item changes, and how many lines of code changed, and so on. So it will be running for a few seconds now. It's the first time we run a build server today, so it might be a little bit slower. So he can run, and that's fine with us. Close, 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 and close. So step one in every project that you have in TFS after you checked in is create a build, well, have a build server ready, and create a build definition that will run those ugly MS build tasks for you. And there we are. It compiles, no warnings, no errors. That's good. So if we miss a file, for example, if we use a file somewhere here, new class, class A, let's call it, and we add a class just to the folder in here and call it the same way, and we forget to check it in, for example, and it's not part of our solution, so we will still get a feedback from the build server that it's not working. Are you using the automated build of TFS? Well, less than TFS users in the room. Okay. Good to know. So now what happens if I actually break the build? So if I just remove one of those curly braces here. I always wanted to break a build in my life. Let's get that out. So there is no mechanism that you are getting notified when something happens on the build server. You can subscribe for email alerts if you like to. You can also use a small tool that is part of Visual Studio, but you have to run that once. It's hidden somewhere in Visual Studio 2010, and now I have to look it up in under Team Foundation Server Tools. It's the build notification tool, and this is the first time it runs. It asks me to configure which build definitions I want to look for. I'm interested in the new Dev Days EasyCalc main CI. If anybody is invoking a new build, starting or finishing it, I'd like to be informed. So now we will get a balloon. Well, we're getting enough balloons from Windows already, but now we're getting even more balloons between the Windows updates and, I don't know what, our security warnings. Now somewhere in between, you will see your build server results telling you if the last build was successful or not. And he tells me now the last build was broken. Let me rebuild it just to see if he shows us a notification. In this list, you can see that it's actually an automatically triggered continuous integration build. This icon says it's continuous integration. So the problem with continuous integration, I mean, it's a good idea to always check after checking in that the code is okay. We're just doing compilation right now, not more. It's a good thing. But if you work on larger teams, or you often have that problem that somebody checks something in and it breaks your current version, it's not enough. It's too optimistic because it's already checked in. It just verifies that what you have checked in was wrong, but it's too late. It's already in the source code. If somebody gets the code, he has a non-working version. So Microsoft did a few changes and said, okay, what we need is a pessimistic version of continuous integration, which they call gated check-in, which works the other way around, which first asks the build server to build something and then goes to the version control system and checks in under your name if the build, including all the quality checks of the build, worked. I'll show you that in a second, but let's first change the code to compile again. Did we get a balloon, by the way? Not yet, right? It will be there in a few seconds. I think it's only polling TFS every minute or something for new results, so it might take a while. Fixed it again. So only compiling is definitely not enough to do an automated definition of done check. We need more. We need naming conventions. We need architecture checks. Of course, we need those unit tests that everybody's talking about and nobody likes to write. That's reality. Oh, there it is, by the way. Build broken. A little bit late. And now it's build succeeded. That was fast. There's a registry key where you can set the polling interval so it gets your messages a little bit faster. Or, again, you can use the team alerts explorer and ask for build alerts, get me an email on failed builds and send it to my local adventureworks.local local email account, only failed builds, thank you, subscription, save. And now we need Outlook somewhere to receive those. Good. So if it happens again, we'll get an email so we're sure we know that the build broke. Let's continue. Of course, we need unit testing. It doesn't work without unit testing. We have automated build. We have continuous integration already. Now let's do unit testing. We go to the business logic. We click the add method. We create unit tests. And he compiles the code, and he asks me to create a new project. We have no team project, no test project already. It will be the easycalc.test project. It will only have one unit test. That's not superb, but it's a start. Are you using the unit testing features from Visual Studio? Anybody? Yeah, a few ones. I like that behavior that if you actually write an empty unit test, it doesn't fail. It's just passing because it's not crashing. So Microsoft's definition of done for unit test is if it's not crashing your machine, it works. That's a good unit test, a green unit test. That's interesting. So let's say if we pass in a 3 and a 7, we'd like to have a 10 as a result. We can remove the inconclusive line because we have verified the method makes sense now. And all the to-dos are done, and this is our first unit test. We check it in. So now with unit testing. So what is nice about the default behavior of the TFS build templates is that he's now scanning for a project that has test in the name and ends with a DLL. So as long as you have a test in your test project's name, it will pick up all the tests in there. It could be a unit test. It could be something totally different like web tests, UI tests, and stuff. And he will just run them all on the build server, and he will tell me one test runs completed, 100% average pass. Great. So now we have our first test, which is good. But again, we don't know anything about the quality of that test. It could mean that we have an empty test, actually. That passing test could be completely empty. What we need is the code coverage number. Code coverage, I don't like the term code coverage. I mean, it's a technical term because it shows you, if you're running a few tests, how much code is covered, and in a percentage, how much you have and haven't covered. But actually, it's a gap finder. So you're not checking if your tests are good. It's not a quality tool for testing if you have the right unit tests. But it tells you where is production code left that I have never tested with any of my tests. And that includes unit tests, web tests, whatever, all the test types from the Microsoft Visual Studio platform. Okay, let's turn on code coverage. Of course, Microsoft could have made it easy and just create a checkbox, enable code coverage. It's almost as easy. It's just like 11 clicks. Let's start. Now you have to click on the solution to add a solution-wide item, new item. In the category test settings, there is a test settings file with the default name of test settings 1.test settings, which is a great name, but I think I'll rename it to build server.test settings. You have those same files when you're running locally for a unit test, where you can configure what the test engine is actually doing and recording. But in this case, I want to create a new file just for the build server. This is used for my TFS build server. And I want to collect code coverage data. That's the most important one. And the EasyCalc axis is the one I want to instrument. So it will tell me later how much is tested. OK, check that in. Now with code coverage almost enabled. So we have the file, the necessary file. The test settings file is an XML file. Everything is ready, just the build server doesn't know that we created that file. So we go to edit build definition, go to the build process. We go to automated tests, and we tell him, edit, to use a test settings file that we have in version control, which is the build server test settings. Okay, okay, really okay, save it. And now, if we again queue up a new build, we will get a percentage, and if we want also the lines of code which are tested, which are not tested, or in other words, where the gaps are, where we might add a few unit tests. By the way, every failed build we have creates a new work item, which is not really nice. Create work item on failure. So I'm getting a new bug work item in the system for every failing build. Ooh, that's a lot. Let's turn that off. False. No work item, please. I'm getting an email. That's enough for me. Did we get emails, by the way? No emails yet. What does he say? It's working. Okay. Another thing that is very interesting is this here. The automated tests, as I said, he's looking for every assembly that has tests in the name and executes it. But what happens if a test fails? There we go. We have code coverage data. Back to the test. If a test fails, let's say we expect as a result 11, which is probably not the right thing to expect. Let's fail a test. And while this is compiling, we're looking at the last successful build, and we can open the test results, and the test results will show me one passing test, and I can switch over by right-clicking to code coverage, and I can see the code coverage data and go down to the classes, and I can see my data layer is tested 100% coverage. Can you do that? See? So easy sometimes. Like real life. Now the result of the new build, where the compilation was okay, but we had one unit test failing, is the result is called build partially succeeded. Please, what? What is a partially succeeded build? So it's half okay. As a tester, should I test it? Should I not test it? Is it something I can give to my client or not? Can I do an update? Can't I do an update? It doesn't tell me anything. I mean, I know that there's a problem with the test, but I don't know what that means. It could be that actually the test code is wrong. In our case, this is the case, right? The adding works, the code works. It's just the test being wrong. Nobody has had the time to customize the test and adapt it to the new changes, which we will do right now. Fix it again. So you can't be sure in those cases what that really means if you get a partially succeeded. If you don't like that state as much as I don't like it, you can turn it off and you can ask the automated test to always fail if there's a test failure. Because just getting more and more failed tests doesn't help you. You still have to consider what does it mean. Is it just I need to invest more time in testing? Or so now, any test fails, the whole build is a failure. There's only green and red left. There's no partially in-between state anymore now. I actually like the icon of both, right? The successful and the failed icon. It's nice. So we're getting better, right? So we have automated build, we have continuous integration, we have our first unit tests, we have code coverage that tells us where to add more unit tests if we're not having 100% code coverage as I do in all my projects. No, not really. Oh, by the way, did I tell you that the code coverage engine, there is an attribute you can put over a class and code coverage will ignore that one class? I haven't told you that, right? If anyone asks you, wasn't me. Especially for UI code where you maybe don't want to test every little inch, it might be something you want to consider. Of course, I forgot the name of the attribute and I never told you that, but that's fine. Okay, let's go back. What can we do more? So when we would not have 100% test coverage, what would we do? We would look for the code coverage data. We will go into the code and look at the lines where we need to add more and more unit tests to cover those. And you will discover probably that you need to write a lot of unit tests. I have only one unit test checking one scenario, one positive scenario. We have not a single negative scenario in this test matrix, and we need to add a lot of tests now. But instead of adding a lot of tests, wouldn't it be better to say this is something our project manager or requirements guy are supposed to do? They can define if I put 3 and 7 as an input value and 110 as a result. So it would be maybe easier to just have a database or a CSV file or an Excel sheet that my people on the requirements side can use to just define those test cases, and I just run one test. And lucky enough, this is something we can do. And with our favorite tool for project management, Microsoft Excel. So we can have a number A, a number B, and a results column. And then if we add 1 and 2, we expect 3. If we add 1 and 3, we might expect 4. If we add 1 and 4, no. Okay, 3 enough. And we will save this as a CSV file. That list is huge. Where's the CSV gone? But it's still there. You see the old formats still work. They're still there. And we will put that right into our test project, which is in here. Add numbers CSV. You will lose formatting. That is fine. Are you sure? Yes, I think I am. I haven't actually read it. Oh. Not sure yes was the right thing, but let's have a look. Looks good, doesn't it? Well, CSV actually is comma-separated value, right? Is that a comma? Not in my world. Anyway. So now we have to find the right window to get the properties of the add test. And you know, finding windows in Visual Studio is always a journey. You have all the windows in here. Those are all windows. You have the other windows, which are the interesting windows. While debugging, well, yeah, they came later, right? It's extended thing. While you're debugging, the most important windows are in here. Now they're not here while we're not debugging. And then all features of the upper editions of Visual Studio add more window menus. So data has a few windows. We have architecture a few windows. We have the test windows. We have the analyze windows. And there's not a single window in the window menu. There are no windows. Usability. So I think we're looking for test window. Test view, yes please. You have made changes, that's true. There's an add test, and this test is enabled, which is good, has no timeout, which is good, and we can have a data access method of sequential. That means we're reading in the whole Excel sheet and we're going in an order through it, not a random order, but a sequential order. And we will now bind this test against a CSV file. And that file is in a totally different directory than the one proposed from the dialogue. And that file, and it doesn't look right. Let's actually make a CSV file out of this. Can't be that bad, can it? Replace them all. There we are. Retry. No, he's not rereading it. Why should he? Now he is. Oh, that looks good. Now it's a real comma-separated file. Are you sure? I think yes. Are you? Yes, I am. Do not show. Thanks. So we have a data source attribute. Once the unit testing engine from Microsoft sees a data source attribute, he will load that whole Excel sheet into memory or the CSV file or whatever it is, or database. Remember, the whole thing, right? If you have like 3 million data sets, you need a lot of memory on that machine. He's always taking the whole test amount. And then he's rerunning the add test for every row in that data source. And now we have to replace our fixed coded values here with something more precise, which is called test context data row. Give me the current data row and give me the first value out of it. You can also take the field names if you like, but I think not in the CSV file. And now we need to convert this to something more meaningful. Actually, it is an integer, I think. Is it? Is it not? Too much of a risk. Let's convert it. Less risky. Build succeeded. It might actually work. Right click, run test. Oh no, it might not work. It works. But it will not work on the build server, will it? Now with a data bound unit test. So what we got out of a data bound test is that instead of writing a lot of unit tests with many scenarios, we are just writing one generic unit test, binding it to a data source. And now we can use data from a real production machine, which we just exported into something like XML or CSV and use that data. And we can take the responsibility for updating those test data and give it to somebody else, not the development team anymore, and ask people from the test team or from the requirements team or whoever's in that project to actually check in new versions of that file. So what does my build server say? Anything happening on the build side? Wow, actually works, he says. Well, the total code coverage is only 26%. That's not good. Details? Yep. The method was executed 3 times. All 3 passed. So we have that as well. Good. Let's continue. We have unit tests. We have code coverage. We have data-driven unit tests. We can add more things to see how our code behaves. Oh, how about my favorite one, the Microsoft FXCOP code analysis? I'm sure you love that one. Thousands of warnings. Let's activate code analysis. And you have to select a rule set if you activate Microsoft Rules Engine. Those are the rules that Microsoft used for the .NET framework, the initial version, to have it consistent. And we can actually select our own rule set if we want to. So let's create one. It's also a solution item. Add new item, category rule, code analysis rule set, and give it a name. What name can we have? It's Microsoft's recommended naming rules, for example. Let's use the Microsoft naming conventions. So now we get the list of all possible rules that Microsoft has: usage, reliability, portability, or naming conventions. And we can click the ones we really want. We can decide if it's more a warning or an error thing. Let's stick with a warning. Let's change the name of the rule set to actually match the file name. MS recommended naming rules. Description, the same naming conventions as the .NET framework is using. So we have that file, we turn it on, we select that file, Microsoft recommended naming rules, save that, close this. Right click, check in, really check in, yes please. Now with code analysis turned on. This also does not require me to change anything on the build server side, because if I turn it on in the project, he will just use that one. You can actually override it on the build server. So you can say, although the people have not turned on code coverage on the local side, we still want to do it on the server side. So you can override this in one of those properties for the server. So what does he tell me? Ah, in method businesslogic.add, consider providing a more meaningful name than parameter name A. And the same thing for B. Thank you. Great tips. Two warnings. Good. So now our definition of done is getting better. So we have a lot of coding conventions now in here. We have a lot of functional tests with the unit tests. We are using test data. It's really, really getting better, I think. But now we need something more interesting. How about our architecture? I promise you we have those three layers in our calculator, our very impressive architecture. We can check that we actually made no mistake in our architecture by going into the first layer, right-clicking the command equals, and creating a sequence diagram. Well, if you have Visual Studio Ultimate, of course, you can right-click and create a sequence diagram just to check that those three layers are still there, that it's the calls are correct. So you see three lifelines, as they are called. The first one is my main window. The main window is calling the constructor of the business logic, and that one is not asynchronous, so it has to return first. And then we are calling the add method. The add method is calling the constructor of the data layer. This one is returning. And then we're actually calling the add method of the data layer, and we're returning the result, and we're returning result again. Whew. But it looks correct. Close this down, close this down, close this down. Now we will add a new project to draw our architecture of type modeling project. A modeling project. EasyCalc models. Models or architecture models like this. I don't know, just do it. I was never a fan of reading. Now we will add a new architecture diagram called Layer Diagram 1, which is a great name to describe an architecture. And we take the toolbox, and every good architecture contains layers. You can draw many and as many you like and have them connected using dependency arrows. You can make it a little bit nicer, like this. How about a layer besides it for everybody to use? This is like a common maybe layer, and everybody is supposed to use the common layer and allowed to. So we are still disconnected from our actual code, right? It's just a logical, purely logical architecture diagram. It has nothing to do with our code at that standpoint, and we will change that later. The layers need names. You can be very creative here if you like to. There is something in the front. There is a layer behind it. And there's the last one. And if you are more a somebody who can remember colors instead of text, you can use coloring. There are many interesting possibilities here. Now that's architecture. So if you always wanted to start with software architecture, this is a great start. You can add comments, but that's not so interesting. So if you have very complex solutions, what you have to do here, or what you can do, you can have a layer with sub-layers in there, so you can have really a multi-layering view also in one of those layers. But I think this is enough. We're talking about references here. Those dependency arrows are references that are used in code, in the Microsoft IL code. So it will scan our output for hard references to another assembly. Now we have to do the mapping to our actual code. Usually I would take either assemblies or namespaces to do the mapping. In this case, we have a very simple solution. We only had three classes, so we'll do it on the class level. But you could do it on namespaces or assemblies as well. How do you select the namespace? You do that using the new windows. Once you found the window, it's architecture windows. It's way easier than selecting architecture windows. Seems to be remembering the shortcut. It's a double shortcut, which is pretty nice. Can I remember that? No, I can't. That's okay. Architecture Explorer. Get me that one. So the Architecture Explorer allows me to select parts of my code. I can select a class or a namespace or multiple namespaces or just a method and map it to one of those layers I just created. So we have a class view, for example, so I see all my classes and I can take one or multiple of them and just draw them over. Or maybe we need more of them, or maybe not. Or just a method, if I wanted to. Or if we go into the other view, we can actually get assemblies and files and see what is in a file, which class is contained by that file. For our case, I think main window and application, this is our front. The business logic seems to be behind it. And the data layer is the last one. And here's the full list of all the mappings we created. They all support automated validation, which is what we want to do. Save, right-click, validate my architecture. Is my architecture correct, Visual Studio? Please tell me. I didn't ask for good, right? Good or nice or the right architecture. I ask, is it correct to the diagram I just... Architecture validation succeeded. Zero suppressed. Okay. No errors means seems to work. Let's check that in. Now with architectural layer validation. Check it. We need to tell the build process, though, that we want to do an architecture validation. And there are many, many parameters how you can control that default build process. And there is none for that one. But that's fine. So I will type, and you will see a checkbox. Can we agree on this one? So you see a checkbox. It tells you something like validate architecture, and you just check it. Okay? Let me check that. So I check the checkbox, close the build definition, and once we rerun it, now the layer diagram should be part of it. Build 13, that's not a good sign. Let's just stop that one and start another one, maybe. No, that's fine. While we're waiting for the build, and obviously we're expecting a successful build because the architecture is working, we can change the trigger from our build, that's the wrong one, edit definition, go to trigger mode, gated check-in. We're now switching over to the pessimistic version of continuous integration that will first ask the build server to do something and then check in the changes if we were successful. That is good. Build succeeded, great. So let's destroy something that is not so obvious that the compiler would see it. We go to maybe the application. Well, let's go to the main window. And in the main window, we will not talk to the business logic, but directly to the access layer. Data layer. So maybe we have a new intern in the company. He's new. He just learned our coding guidelines. And he found a shortcut how to more quickly develop by just using our data access layer without adding all those methods, those unnecessary methods in the business logic. So he just created that shortcut, and he wants to check that in. Hooray, I found a shortcut. I'm sure my colleagues will love me. No, that's fine. Check in, and now TFS will say, wait. This Team Foundation server project is protected by a gated check-in. I will send your changes to the build server. So what technically happens, it will take only the modified files from my hard disk, will put them into a shelf, and the build server will first get the latest version from TFS and then open my shelf, unshelve it on top, and will try to compile that and do all the steps we've seen, the unit testing, the code coverage, the architecture validation, everything we configured. And if anything goes wrong, we have never checked in. It says validating gated check-in, which is good. If you have questions, it's a great moment now. Yes, you have. Oh, does he easily see if it's checked in or not? It's asynchronous. That means it can take some time. So you will get a notification, not instantly, But at some point, while you're working at something else maybe, like half an hour later, there will be a dialogue telling you things like, you remember that check-in half an hour ago? No. Not good. Reject it. You will see that dialogue in a second. I think after 30 seconds or something, it will just pop up. It pops up behind the window of Visual Studio, which is nice because you're writing something else and then there's a window coming, a message box, which is not so nice. Yes, please. Yes. Oh, you want to enforce that people write comments when checking in? Yes. Let me tell you that in a few seconds. And first continue with this one, comments. In a second. Now, what we've got here is the gated check-in failed, which is good. This is what we expected. The layer diagram says you screwed up our architecture, and actually you did it two times. Why? How can I do it twice with one call? Because you're calling the constructor of the data layer class that you're not supposed. It's in a different layer. And you're calling the add method, so two things that you've done wrong. You can see here you're calling from the front layer to the last one layer, and this is a call which is not, you're not supposed to do. This was the add method, and this is data layer dot data layer, so this is the constructor. All the other things are still there. This is the dialogue. You see it flashing behind Visual Studio. And if you click on it, it will tell you, whoa, check and reject it. If you have worked on something else now, you can unshelve to get back to that. If you haven't, you just say ignore, and you can now fix your architecture again. So the gated check-in really makes sense if you have a lot of people checking in, a large team, and continuous integration is just not enough because it's broken all the time. If you think of large companies, if a large company really has 100 people working on a project, and there are really 100 brilliant developers, and each of them just breaks the build once a year, that means every second day we have a broken build, which is a lot. So they use or like to use gated check-in builds. For you, I would say start with continuous integration. It's enough for small teams, so go back to the continuous integration trigger. But if you now want to ask the build server privately, can you just check what I'm doing right now in my workspace and just tell me and nobody else? Just do a private build and tell me if it would work on the build server? Yes, you can do that. So you can go to your build server and say, can you queue me a new build? But no, I have to turn that off now first. No trigger type, otherwise it's disabled. Like this. Now, queue new build, and now, can you do me a new build, but don't take the latest sources? Take the latest sources with a little bit of spice from my own workspace that I will put you into a shelf set, which we will create now. So this is my local, this is a backup of my local workspace. And now we created a shelf with all our local changes. Now we're sending that off to the build server. And now it's the same thing like gated check-in, just that nobody else sees it because it's not an official build, it's a private build. And it's tagged as a private build, and nobody else can see what I'm screwing up here, and I can be sure that nobody will be angry. That's nice, isn't it? You had a question, sir. Yes, code coverage. Code coverage is an interesting one. Most of the stuff we've seen on the server side actually runs in the build server. And it also worked for TFS 2008, but you have to install Visual Studio on the build server. It doesn't sound to be the right thing to do, but you have to, because a lot of the tools are still in Visual Studio, and code coverage is the one you still have to install Visual Studio for it. So I have Visual Studio, in my case, Ultimate, but Premium would be enough. I have it on my build server just to get code coverage data. That's the thing you have to do. So it's still broken. That's what we expected. If you need licensing tips for your build server, you can ask me afterwards. Off the recording. So let's go back to the last working version that looked way better than this one. So you asked about comments, how we can enforce comments and stuff. We still have those concept of check-in policies. The check-in policies are not as good as a build because they are run locally. You can set those policies, and if you have the power tools installed, which I encourage you always to install. This is the wrong one. Go to source control policies. You can add a few check-in policies here or write your own ones. But again, this is executed locally. So if you say you want to make sure that comments are entered, this will be checked on your Visual Studio. Or some tests are executed, certain code coverage rules are enforced. You have to click a work item. You can actually also create your own ones. One of my favorite customers asked me to create this don't check in late in the afternoon check-in policy, because they tend to say that their developers are not checking in high-quality code if they want to go home in a few minutes. So they only want their people worldwide to check in the morning time frame so that they can have a build before they go home and they see what they have screwed up, and the quality of changes is way better in the morning hours. So this is something you can build on your own. And this is the change set comments policy. You will only see this change set comments policy that you must enter a comment if you installed PowerTools. So what if you have not installed PowerTools in one of your machines? You will get a warning, an error from that check-in policy. It's just a different one. It's called internal error in check-in policy. Once you get an internal error from a check-in policy, usually it means it's not installed. But that's a good thing, actually. So you can now force that everybody has to install PowerTools by just activating the comments policy, and who has not installed the PowerTools gets an internal error. Who has installed the PowerTools gets an error that he has not supplied any comments. And if he has installed PowerTools and has put comments in there, everything works. So it's the best way to make a check that everybody has Team Foundation PowerTools installed. Just use that policy. And actually, I hope Microsoft is not moving over that policy to Visual Studio itself, because then I have no way to check that people have the PowerTools anymore. So it's a great deployment thing. Now, I think we've used most of the automated stuff we can do for a Windows Forms application. If we were to have a web application, a simple calculator on the web, we could start with things like web performance tests now and add the load tests, where you really create more users, virtual users, all accessing that website. You probably know that the Visual Studio Ultimate Edition now can create unlimited amount of virtual users. It's not something you have to buy as it was in the past. Now it's part of Visual Studio Ultimate. I think the only limitation is your hardware and your network cards and your network where you try to test that. So everything of that kind can be included and works great. But once you've done all that testing stuff, the next step is to automatically deploy that into something like a lab, right? If it's on a web server, you would deploy it to a test web server. If it's a Windows application, you want to install it on a test lab, and your testers will work on it. And once your testers start creating manual tests and click through the application, they will find bugs, they go back and forth. And at some point, when your features are done, it would make sense to automate the manual clicking of your testers, so you have regression tests in future. Because whenever you change something in your code, you want to make sure that you have not broken anything that worked before. And you can do that using UI tests. And UI tests also work for Windows, for WPF, for Silverlight, for web applications. And in this case, I want to add a web test, a UI test. I want to test our Windows application. And I want to add that to my build server. This is usually not something you would do. You would have a real separate machine where you want to test your software. You don't want to see if your software is running on a build server. You want to see if it's running on an environment that looks like your production environment. Anyway, we'll put it on the build server and hope that it works as well. So let's grab our output, which is the EasyCalc axe, put it on the desktop as a shortcut. That looks good. And we go to the test project and we add a new coded UI test. Now he will ask me, do you want to record the test right now, or do you have a tester that already clicked through the application while he was running Microsoft Test Manager, so we can use his recording and create a unit test out of that? I will have to restart and do it from scratch. Now the coded UI test builder is coming on the screen, is appearing, and we can start recording. And we should be careful to not record too much. I usually just click one or two times and then stop the recording and generate code out of it. So you get a lot of small methods. If something changes on your UI flow, you just have to exchange one of those methods then. So you're not recording like 30 minutes, but just like a few seconds, let's create code. And he creates methods for every time that you say create code. So we're just starting the application. That's enough. Break, create code, start, easy, calc, add and generate. Good. Let's continue. Now we have two numbers, 3 and 7 equals break, generate code. Add 3 and 7. Add and generate. Now, a good unit test does not only consist of clicking and doing actions and performing something, but also of the verification that the result is correct in those assert statements, as we call them. So in this case, it's easy because we have the result on the screen. We can just grab the 10 out of that text box, which we will do now. If it's a more complicated application, you have code behind it. So you can do everything you can do in code. You can look into the database and see if the new value really is added to a table or whatever you've done in your code, or if a web service, call any web services to see if it's correct. Now we take the control picker, and we can now go to the 10. This is a WPF application, so the technology in use is UIA to get those values out of it. If you have something like a web application, you will see the document object model from your Internet Explorer on your browser window. And the text right now is 10. So add an assert statement that the text is r equal 10. Now we get a check mark, so this is an assert statement, and we generate code for this. Assert result is 10. Add and generate. And it definitely makes sense to record the closing of the application. Otherwise, every build opens one new window and nobody's closing it. Okay, we will not record the closing of the window. For whatever reason. Let's see if there's a solution. Did that ever work for you? Did you ever get a solution back? Sometimes I have, actually. So now we have three methods. The fourth one crashed. So we have the start easy calc, add 3 and 7, assert result is 10, which also makes a good test, but it's not closing the window. But again, let's start it. Let's see if it works locally. It's magically running. You should not touch mouse or keyboard right now because he's using it. Although he can click in the background. This is something I want you to do, right? You can't click in the background of another window. He can. That's a real tough one. Huh? So you have like an Outlook window popping up or something, and you see the window behind. He's just clicking and working through. That's cool stuff. So he says green, it works. Well, yeah. I'm not sure that's true. Let's do a check and change something. Let's go to assert result is 10 and change the assert statement, which is behind this. The 10 is, by the way, this here means 10, right? This is the expected value of 10. Let's just remove that and say 11 and see what happens. Yeah, he's not really known for very short expressions. That's true. So now we're expecting 11, so it should fail if the test is correct. Failed with the reason of expected 11, the actual value was 10. Okay, seems to work. Let's repair that again, back to the old value. I like that. We still need to record the closing of the application because I don't like that. So the good news is, and this was the reason why I created those short methods, I can go somewhere in between now and ask them, for example, here to generate a new recording and add that right here, the window still open. Start recording, close the window, there's no crash, yes. Pause it, and close my beautiful calculator. Add and generate, write the code, thank you. Close again, back to Visual Studio. Now we got to close my calculator, now it should run. Great, passed. Now we want to do this on the build server. How do we do that? So we can check it in, but I'm sure it will not work. Now with UI testing. And I could open the Team Foundation Administration Console already, which will help me with this. Oh, I deactivated the continuous integration to show you the last thing. There we go. I'm opening the build server configuration in the back to be ready for us in a few seconds. So he will discover the new test. He sees there's a new coded UI test. He will try to run it. But the problem usually is on a build server that you can't just run Windows and create new windows and handles for Windows, because you're running as a Windows service, which the build server essentially is. And due to new security things, starting with Windows Vista, as a service you can't just create a window and show something on the UI, because you don't have a desktop where somebody is actually working on. So you see, although it's running locally, it tells me on the build server, I'm sorry, it doesn't work. There was an error calling initialization methods. Please see the Microsoft how to interact with your desktop guidance. I don't know. So what we can do, we can ask the build server for this case to run as an interactive application. So we stop the service. We wait a lot. Yes, sir. Can I also do the UI test on web applications? Yes, sir. You have to record it with Microsoft Internet Explorer. And you can, when you run them, you can use Firefox or IE. Yes. So and the only difference is you will get the HTML, the DOM output from IE. You really see the document object model for your assert statements. So now I don't want to use a Windows service. I want to use an interactive process. And I want to remember what my password was. That was not my password, he tells me. That's an easy one. We know how to reset this one. This is my password, by the way. Do I have another one? No. I always use the same password. How to configure a build machine? So there's a separate account for my build server, as usual, and it has a very secret password of ABC. And now it will run a console application in interactive mode. And this console application now is a Windows service, and or it acts as a Windows service would do. It's not the same Windows service. And it can now execute all the things I need. So if I rerun my build, and we are now the build server, so we will see that it should actually do all that stuff. Oh, it might actually fail, but that's expected, you know, right? That's all expected, just for learning purposes. Yes. If you do that with your real build server, if you really want to try that, you will probably have to do a few things. You should have a user that will automatically log in into Windows. You can set this in the registry so that nobody has to log in into that machine. So it automatically logs in. Then you put this window, the new build service, into the autorun group, into the startup group. So it will run with every Windows start. And then you have a build server that automatically boots up in this interactive mode. Something happening, by the way? Yes. Oh, he's testing. Sorry. He's actually doing something. It works. If you tried this at home, or in your office better, probably not at home, you will get an error because he cannot find the .exe file. In my case, the build server is the same as my development machine, so the path to the .exe file is definitely the same, and it's hard-coded in the unit test. If you want to try this at home or in your company, do the following. Find the path. The path is somewhere hidden in the UI map designer, the application under test, XE, alternative XE path. Here it is. So this path is true in my case. In your case, it wouldn't be true because the build server definitely looks differently. It has those temp folders and stuff. And actually, he's now testing the wrong version. He's not testing the build output. He's testing my version on my machine. Because this is not the build server path, is it? So what you can do here, you can add the right path. And the right path is something like C, builds, 1, the name of your team project, and then the path in your version control. So this is the real path, and if you add this one and add a at sign, now he will test the right thing. Well, it's not still true, because he will first check this path, and only if the first one doesn't work, he will try the second one. So I have to remove those files first. Right click, clean solution. Now he will use the alternative exe path. So yes, you can do UI testing for Windows apps, for web apps, for Silverlight apps, for WPF apps. You can do that on your build server if you like. It would be better to not do it on the build server, but on a separate machine which really looks as your production environment. You can do that. You can install a test agent on that machine to actually execute and record information. And if you really want to do more of this, you can use those Microsoft Lab Management, which you probably have heard of. It's a free part of TFS. So if you own a TFS license, you have that license as well. And then it can spin up new virtual machines, install your software, run your test on those machines. And if anything goes wrong, he will not only create a screenshot, he will actually also freeze those machines and send you a snapshot attached to your bug in TFS, which is pretty neat. But you need virtual machines for this. And this one works without. So you can combine everything you learned today, obviously. So the new coded UI test is also generating code coverage data. We're doing the same stuff as the unit test, but anyway, we're getting code coverage data for the coded UI test as well. And you can also use the coded UI test and now add the same attribute that we configured to use the CSV file, if you like to. And then we have those parameters, and we can use them from here. And now we have parameters, and now we add them here, A and B, and you will get the expected value. Expected? Almost. 3 and 7. Oh, that looks beautiful, that code. How about we will just replace this with A? I know it's not a naming full parameter name. I know what Microsoft FXCup would say now, but that's fine. And this will be the expected value, and we will replace that. It's all code, so we can change everything we want to. It makes sense to not do that in the designer file where I am right now. It makes sense to take those methods you modified manually and put them over to the UI map itself, so it will not get overridden when Microsoft is recreating that file, so Visual Studio is recreating something. Build is in progress. Build is still in progress. Build has completely failed. Oh, yes. We are working on it. What's this now? Oh, we have test method already in the name. It's in the line above. This is an integer. Yes, sir. Two strings sounds very good. You see, the more complex software gets, the more you're happy that all your automation, all your definition of done is completely automated, and you don't have to worry about that as well. It's hard enough to write good code, as you see. Now with data-driven UI tests against a WPF app. And now while he's testing, I expect him to execute the software 3 times. You can take the time, and if you have questions, and raise them now. Yes, sir. Yes. Setup projects, off the record, afterwards the session. There's no good solution. Let's keep it. Well, I have a few ideas, but no good solution. Yes, sir.
Code metrics.
Now you can automate them. It's possible. There is a command line tool now, but you have to actually change the build process template to do that. So everything I've showed you today is what you can just do by clicking. This took me like 15 minutes in preparation. If just taking the calculator and bringing it to that, what we have here, is 15 minutes of work. So this is something you can do for every of your projects. If you want to do more, like integrating the code metrics engine, then you have to actually open that XAML file. And 90% of the time, you will spend just finding out where to place it in that huge build definition file. Once you found it, it's easy. On my slide deck, there is a more information last slide, and you have a link that explains where to put it if you want to do code metrics and how to integrate it. Yes, sir. How do you filter out certain tests? Yes, especially because I have the UI tests, which do not run on a typical server. So there was that concept of test lists, but it's not the major concept anymore. So what you can do is just use categories. Have you seen those already? Categories? It's like a tag. So you give it a tag like, oh, I'm a UT, I'm a unit test. And the other one is something different. The other one is not here anymore, but there he is. And the other one is I'm a UIT, I'm a UI test. And now you have those categories. Now you go to the build server and you tell the build server to do automated testing as configured, but check for the following criteria. For example, UT would mean only execute unit tests, or I can tell him unit tests or UI tests, or is the, that sign, the bang operator, as we call it. Yeah. So this is how you can configure which tests you really want to get executed. So that's it. I hope he's still working on the build and closing the windows after he's done. Looks like he's still thinking about something, but I expect this to finish within the next minutes. So I hope you enjoyed it a little bit. You've seen what you can do with minimum effort. This is really something basic you can do for every project. There's no need to have any project without an automated build. And gradually step that up as you like. And if you want to do more, it's still possible. I have links on this on my slide deck, but this is just the basic stuff that you can really do. Start with automated build, do continuous integration or gated build, add the automated tests, add automated deployment. And then number five is, if you reach that level, call me and I have a few new ideas then. I don't have them now yet, but I will. Once you reach number five, I will have new ideas. That's perfect. So don't forget, define quality in your team, write down a definition of done, and try to automate it using those five steps I've just shown you. This is the more information slide. If you have questions, I'll be here around, and enjoy Dev Days. Thank you very much.